Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends. But the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as though he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Harry Shearer is an iconic American entertainer who divides his time between New Orleans and Southern California. An actor, comedian, broadcaster, musician, and writer, Shearer was a Saturday Night Live cast member, but is likely best known for his roles as bassist Derek Smalls in the film and similarly named band, This is Spinal Tap, and for voicing iconic characters on The Simpsons, including Mr. Burns, Waylon Smithers, Principal Skinner, Ned Flanders, Reverend Lovejoy, Kent Brockman, Dr. Julius Hibbert, and many, many more. Harry's latest work is a new album called The Many Moods of Donald Trump, which is due out in October 2020, just ahead of the U.S. presidential election, and via Twankey Records, a label Shearer co-owns with his wife, Judith Owen. Harry and I connected recently for a talk about the state of America in the summer of 2020, the power and limitations of comedy and other art forms to affect change, a short history of political polarization and mass media production and consumption, whether or not The Simpsons have actually ever really predicted the future, the inspiration behind the many moods of Donald Trump, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you, who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Andy Schaaf, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 558th episode of Creative Control, featuring the multifaceted comedic force Harry Shearer, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Harry. How's it going?
Hello, Vish. It's going all right. How are you?
Not bad. Not bad, as I often do when I begin a conversation like this one. I ask my guests, where in the world are you? Where in the world are you today, Harry?
Well, I'm in Southern California at the moment. I live mainly in New Orleans, but I came back out here to do some work. I'm actually to shoot the motion capture stuff for my new Donald Trump video, which should be out middle of next month.
Okay, great. Now, by the way, I just am marveling. I'm a little creeped out by the video you've released thus far. It is some kind of... Actually, I'll let you describe it, but it's a bit bizarre. It makes me wonder if we're going to actually know what our memories are, what reality is, because it's a manipulation. What is your latest... You just put out a lyric video. Last night? That's different.
Yeah.
For COVID 180. But Son-in-Law. Tell us about the video for Son-in-Law. How was that made?
The song is, as it seems to be, Donald Trump's ode to his chief senior advisor in charge of all things, Jared Kushner. And since I'm singing it in his voice, I wanted it to look as if he's singing it as well. And I was in Sydney, Australia in February. My wife and I were touring down there. And just before they closed the country, I got to have a meeting with a gentleman, Matt Hermans, who runs a small visual effects studio. Not small, but I mean compact, lean. Mm-hmm. And I said, can you do a motion capture video where I'm performing as Donald Trump? He said, yeah. So it turned out to be a little more complex than that. It turns out to use... Aside from motion capture video, a couple of other technologies that he had to make sure would play nice with each other. And it turns out it's almost as complex to make machines play nice with each other as it is to make people play nice with each other. But I came back to L.A., shot my performance, and then we worked COVID style, a Skype call about every 2 or 3 days to look at the footage and start shaping it and start... calling shots and doing other little adjustments, adding jokes. And after about 3 months, it was finished. It was Matt, the guy in the studio in Sydney, said it was the first time he'd done all of that stuff that was involved, where he just did a second video for another song on the Donald Trump collection and went much faster. So the learning curve is working.
Yeah, for sure. So I mean, maybe the answer is rather obvious, but what exactly inspired this project, the album, I mean? What inspired you to take this particular, you know, cultural form as a means of expressing your thoughts on this president and maybe this time?
Well, I do a weekly radio show here in the States on public radio, not NPR, but an independent public radio. And I make fun of the news. And sometimes I write sketches that I do all the characters in. And sometimes, more frequently recently, I write songs. And at the beginning of this year, I looked back and I noticed, wow, I've written a lot of songs involving Donald Trump, because he's, you know, he's a guy who, this may not come as a surprise to your listeners, wants to be noticed. So he says and does almost anything just to get into that day's news. And some of it was worthy of a sketch, a comedy sketch. I do this series called The Presidentis. But some of it just inspired song. It's something he'd say or some part of the story that just went, that is a song. So I had a lot of these, and I thought, boy, I could make a collection. I'd take them into the studio with my producer, and 'cause what appears on the radio show are largely demo versions, but then I come into the studio with my producer, he brings in other musicians, we do full-on productions of them, and that's what we did, and I just thought, kind of a good year for it. You know, and yes. And I don't have to explain much about the material, you know, it's in everybody's consciousness. So that's really the idea behind this project.
So your radio show is called Le Show, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how long have you been doing that?
It embarrasses me to say no, I'm counting, because I have to distinguish between the two things I've been doing for a long time, The Simpsons and my radio show. But I think the radio show started earlier, so I think it's over 35 years.
It's something like 83 or something, I think.
Yeah, December of 83.
Yeah, so radio became this medium for you. That's fascinating in itself, given how we're processing information, I suppose, and that you chose music, because this seems like one of the least musical presidents we've had. Like, every president I can think of, they meet with a musician and they bring him in, and Trump has, but they seem like photo ops, and I can't see him like getting down to Kid Rock, so to speak. Do you have a sense? Because I was thinking about the music the two tracks I've heard thus far, COVID 180 and Son-in-Law. The musical choices fascinated me. What prompted that style? They're different styles, first of all.
Yes.
But when you're
yes.
trying to satirize someone with music, I assume the music plays a role, like the sound plays a role. How did you arrive at sounds for a guy who does not seem very musical?
Well, if you listen to the way he talks, he certainly doesn't sound very musical, especially when he reads. He reads in this flat monotone that basically says to me, I don't like reading. I fancy that every one of the styles, and every song in the collection is in a different style, somewhat musical styles that at least were around him during his life, from his youth to his whatever this is.
Yeah.
but that, you know, we're around him, like, you know, the disco portions of COVID 180 seem to me to call back his days at Studio 54, for example, when he was hanging out there. So, you know, not every style that has been popular during his lifetime is represented here. I don't have him doing rap or anything like that. I try to keep it in what I imagine to be the wheelhouse of the music he was most exposed to. And it also was interesting to me to just work with different styles so that the songs themselves have continuing interest and don't, you know, sort of beat the same drum over and over again.
Right. So he does not, I agree with you, he does not come across as a particularly musical person, but in the same line of reasoning, I suppose, he does seem to fancy himself a comedian. That's my read on him. He thinks he's funny. He goes for jokes. And he has arguably a certain rhythm that way. Would you? Well, I'm not suggesting he's a good comedian or a funny person. But do you know what I'm getting at? He, as a comedian yourself, do you see that wannabe impulse in him?
Yeah, I see moments where he's sort of telegraphing, now I'm kidding. I'm not sure he is kidding. You know, he evinced that tell most notably to me and most recently when he said, so I told them, so let's slow down the testing. And his delivery, as I sort of aped it there, suggested to me that he thought he could get away with saying that by pretending he's kidding. I'm not so sure he was kidding. He may have been actually. Now, this is something you'll find strange, but I thought that was one of those odd moments when he was actually telling the truth.
Right. Yes.
And he dresses those up by pretending he's kidding. Whereas when he's lying, he's pretending he's serious. It's a cute little game.
It's a game, but do you feel like maybe I've brought this up with other people, particularly comedians, when I have the opportunity to speak with them, like the right generally seems to be weaponizing comedy these days. So when they say something or do something reprehensible, they say, well, we were just joking. Locker room talk started this whole thing, right?
You liberals have no sense of humor.
You're right. And so that to me is a weird, I don't know. Like I feel like there's so many machinations in everything they do, but that stealing the strength of comedy and turning it against people who actually know how comedy works is very frustrating to me. Have you noticed this?
Well, they borrow. I don't think they regard it as comedy so much as irony. You know, have you no sense of irony? Have you, sir, at long last, no sense of irony?
Right. But I mean, it is coloring how comedians express themselves now. There's a lot of I feel like there's a slight filtration system happening with some comedians because they don't want their words to be misinterpreted. But politicians are going whole hog with it. Like you say, he's a performative speaker. He likes to get in the press. He needs attention.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he's trying to use comedic ideas or notions of comedy to get those things across. And then it makes the news. We all freak out. And then, within a few hours, they say, he was just kidding. He didn't mean we should stop testing. That, to me, is weaponizing comedy in a pure evil form. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I know a little bit about pure evil because I play Mr. Burns.
Yes, you do. And he seems to be running your country now, Mr. Burns, on some level. What happened?
Well, I would say that Mr. Burns is a slightly more strategic thinker than the guy you're talking about. I sense that liberals tend to impute strategy to a person who, in my opinion, is pure id, and his only strategy is getting from this minute to the next minute. In terms of that's why he can say things that are so blatantly at odds with what he said 5 minutes ago. If a traveling salesman came into your living room and started spouting a stream of nonstop blather about, you know, encyclopedias or vacuum cleaners, he would be doing so in a way that would try to obliterate your memory of what he said 5 minutes ago when he said it was free, you know, because now there's a $59.95 extra charge. And Trump is, I think, basically, if you look at what the basic toolkit he uses, it's the salesman's toolkit.
Right.
Trump steaks are the best in the world. I guarantee it. that's still on the internet.
Exactly.
You know, but I never said that. You know, listen to what I'm saying now.
Right.
It's a salesman's toolkit, and so a salesman might pretend to be joking, but he's basically got one thing in mind: buy this thing, or I'll kill you.
Yeah, I mean, you are a comedian, you're a satirist, you're a parodist, I suppose. I mean, that goes without question on some level, which to me means that you've got to be kind of highly attuned to human behavior on some level to properly get at what's going on there. And beyond Trump, I am curious, you know, you're in Southern California, you're in the States. California now, again, an epicenter for this coronavirus. We are all observing the social unrest going on in your country. My question, I suppose, is as someone who observes human behavior ostensibly for a living, what do you make of your country right now, the way people are reacting to these various calamities? What is your perspective on what's going on?
Well, I'm old enough to remember 1968. And I think that's the last time that this country was as fractured, as fragmented, as at these fairly extreme polls. And I'm not referring to the fine Polish people. you know, I think a lot of people forget really how bad it was then. In some ways, it was even more extreme. Three prominent Americans had been assassinated that year. There was a fiendish war going on that young men's asses were being hauled off into involuntarily. So there was a lot of street activity
protests.
In response.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had the what I think most people now would use the terminology the Chicago police riot in front at the Democratic convention in that year. Yeah. It was really a time when people thought, "What the hell is happening with this country?" Much like now, and I think maybe the coronavirus is playing the role of that the war played then in terms of an ongoing event that seemed to have a momentum all its own that could not be controlled, at least by what passes for our government.
Right. And like the war, the virus is both hyper-real and surreal. It feels abstract on some level.
Yeah. I mean, unless you had a relative who was in Vietnam, or unless you have a relative who's been sick with coronavirus, it can, they both can seem abstract, and yet they're horribly real.
Yeah. So you invoke 1968 and the fracture there, the lack of galvanization, the fear that, you know, pervaded your country.
The anger.
And the anger, yes, the rage. And the mistrust, I would say, as well.
Yeah.
So
what,
when you think back on it, how did the corner get turned? How did that, all of that sort of subside into relative normalcy going into the 70s? I only ask this because, frankly, we need a solution to what's going on now. And I just wonder if history, if in your recollection, do you remember when things felt just like maybe we're getting, and then you had the Manson thing, and I mean, the 60s ended badly, and it feels like the 20s are starting
and
badly.
Went into the 70s with Kent State.
Right.
I look at that year, I pick 1968 just as a center of the storm.
Yeah.
But I don't think that all ended well. I think you can look at that period as the time when the left split, and the labor movement under the direction of a fairly conservative, in labor terms, director, George Meany, was in favor of the war. And the rest of the Democratic Party, except for Lyndon Johnson, was against the war.
Right.
And you had labor kind of divided from the Democratic Party, a split that proved, I think, to have long-term consequences for the party, for the left in America.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, it was followed very closely by a highly explicit Republican program to weaken the labor movement, and which has been enormously successful. So I think, but you know, it was in the headlines of that era, it was the long hairs versus the hard hats.
Right.
And that was a very serious split. And I think the scars of it are still present.
Well, you picked 68, and now that you talk about it, but for those who don't know, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, Harry, you did pursue political science studies at Harvard, is that correct?
Undergraduate at UCLA, and then, Harvard for a year.
I just want people to know. Yeah, I want people to know as you speak that you're bona fide. That's all. I'm just
so people. You're credentializing, are you?
I am. This is a job interview, frankly.
Yeah,
it's turned into that. No, I just want people to know that you have a sense of what you're talking about. But you picked 68, and I feel like the subtext of what you're getting at is some dawning of a current understanding of how polarization functions. Because we are at a point where I can't think of in my lifetime, I'm 42. You're going to be 77 this year? Is that right?
Yeah.
Happy birthday?
Thanks.
If I might say in advance.
Yeah.
So you've been around a long time. You pick 68 as this marker of some sort of sea change. Do you remember a time when we weren't this polarized, where like the football league wasn't a political thing, where comedy wasn't political, music wasn't political? Everything's very political now. A ketchup commercial can be politicized.
Mm-hmm.
The truth and lies can be politicized to either person's ends. Do you recall a time in your country in particular where things weren't like this? Because I cannot.
No, I mean, it was pretty bad in that sense during the Nixon era. You had that was really the start of the concerted campaign by Republicans against the media.
Yeah.
You had the vice president talking about the nattering nabobs of negativism,
right.
a phrase from the pen of William Safire, who was later a language columnist for The New York Times.
Right.
And I think that's been pretty consistently true. I mean, You had the Reagan era, which was the sort of dawn of really sophisticated stagecraft in Washington. Washington had been, up until that point, derided as show business for ugly people. And suddenly, you know, the TV people came in and prettied it up and you had a movie actor as president.
Yeah, right.
So it's appropriate. And I just think that these trends have, you know, accelerated and built upon themselves and grown exponentially, as we've learned to say in the recent
exponential
situation.
Growth. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So it seems a systemic part of how, I mean, the media seems hapless in this case too, because they're like a dog chasing a car. Every time there's a soundbite or a news, they have to go after it because we built the for some reason we've decided we need news 24/7. And
well, you know, I think first of all, anybody who studied the career of Donald Trump knows he learned very early on, you say the most outrageous thing, the newspapers print it, you denounce the newspapers, rinse and repeat. And it goes all the way back to when he pretended to be his own PR person, right. calling up the New York Post and giving them, you know, tips like Marla Maple says the best sex ever with Donald. And they knew it was him and they printed it anyway.
Right.
Because it sold papers.
Right.
And his lizard brain understands that they cannot help themselves.
Right.
And, you know, that is his one keen insight into the whole process, is that they never can come to a point where they, I mean, I was saying a couple of years ago, you know, Donald Trump's tweets should be in the "and finally today" section of a newscast, not a "this just in" section.
Right, right.
And they can't even have that much discipline.
Now, what is your take on that? Why is that? Is it what I was saying? It's just that they need to feed the beast. And so whatever he says, like I've noticed some of the American networks are like, we're not covering the speech anymore. We're not covering his speeches anymore. We're not covering his briefings anymore. We can't.
Well, of course, that's because they were CNN, I think, is the one you're talking about.
And MSNBC. Yeah. A couple of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that they were blamed for carrying all of these Donald Trump rallies during the 2016 campaign live. Now, you know, I know enough about the news business to know that if they can hit a button or pull a switch and have minutes and minutes and minutes of airtime filled at no expense and without losing viewers, they'll do it.
Right.
And there were these feeds of Donald Trump speeches, and they didn't lose viewers by going to them live, so they went to them live. And then they get blamed for, well, these were basically campaign contributions. So now, you know, they're flipping in the other direction and going, well, we're not going to do that anymore. but, I mean, I'm old enough to remember a time before the news operations of the networks were expected to be profit centers. And that's a long time ago now.
Yeah.
And ever since, there's been a winnowing. I remember in my childhood, thankfully it was my childhood, when I knew the names of the CBS bureau chief in Rome and Paris and Tokyo. Well, they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
My best example is a couple of years ago, David Gregory, who was then hosting Meet the Press, started the program by saying, we have breaking news this morning from Pakistan. And for the latest, we go to NBC's chief foreign correspondent, Richard Engel, reporting today from London.
Right, right. And that,
'cause you can see Pakistan from there.
So, okay, you are making a not so subtle critique of the ability for the media to function the way it maybe once did. Because I make this argument all the time, too, and I don't mean to sound maybe like a grumpy old man, but it did seem to me that growing up, we all had a couple of sources for news. I mean, growing up, your country, people would watch Walter Cronkite and read the paper, and that was pretty much it. But now that we're so fractured, we get our information from all these different sources. By your estimation, does that not contribute to a lack of galvanization, a lack of understanding, a lack of really recognizing what the truth is in all the noise?
Well, you've said two things that I have to take issue with. One, a little bit of time ago, you said the 24/7 news cycle,
yeah,
which is a cliche that if you turn on MSNBC or CNN in the middle of the night, you're going to see reruns.
Yes, that's true.
so much for the 24/7.
Right, right, right. They do that's repurpose. That's true.
That's a fantasy.
Right.
There's probably a 12-hour news cycle. And secondly, all these sources of information are basically repeating. They're not sources of information. They're sources of repeating information because they don't have most of the places where people get their news. I have this discussion with my wife all the time. She'll point something out from Apple, something called Apple News. And I'll say, well, where's that from? She says, Apple News.
It's an aggregate.
No. Yeah. 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 They just are pulling stuff and repeating what somebody else had spent money, hopefully, finding out.
Right.
There are, you know, there's AP and Reuters and a few newspapers with some reporting heft, the New York Times and the Washington Post, a little bit the LA Times, a couple of the papers in Britain, the Financial Times and the Guardian from two different sides of the street, both have fairly robust reporting structures. But otherwise, I mean, most newspapers are and most news quote sources are reduced to repeating what somebody else spent the money to find out.
Right, right. And but we also have been then accustomed to consuming that same repeated cycle, aren't we? We were accepting this as because my wife says this all the time. If I leave one of these news channels on, she'll come back in an hour and she's like, "Vish, they're saying the same thing they said an hour ago." I'm like, "Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I don't know why I've got it on. I have no idea. What it says something about me. Like I'm a child of the media. I could, when I was a kid growing up in the 80s and 90s, my best friend was the VCR. I was YouTube, Harry, before there was YouTube. I would record everything that I thought was significant, and I'm just a media consuming person. And so I feel I feel like I was built for the internet, and I was built for this. And now it's coming back to haunt me because I, to my wife's point, when she objectively looks at what I'm doing, she's like, this is very weird behavior to just keep watching and processing the exact same information, waiting.
Hoping something different
yes,
will happen.
Yes, just waiting and waiting. It's like the famous cliche about, like, why are they just, you know, showing the presidential podium with no one there? Like, why are we all just watching this like it's a, you know, a fishbowl or whatever? I don't understand. So
I go back in answer to that question to if you can turn on a switch, have a camera feed, and not lose viewers. It's the freest way to fill the time.
Exactly.
In terms of cost,
right.
That's why you know you have all these news channels filling time with people in little boxes telling you what you just saw and what they thought of it.
Right.
Which is you know, man, is that the cheapest way to fill time?
These people
are on. You know, you're paying them. It's like corporations and lawyers. They might as well sue you. Their lawyers are on staff.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the reasons I gravitated towards comedy as a young person is because I kind of felt like I was getting the truth. I mentioned earlier that I view your role as someone who studies kind of human behavior a little bit. And forgive me if that's, first of all, I think you agreed with me at the time, right? That you
yes, I did.
Okay. Yeah. So on some level,
but I'm going to be Trumpian and say, no, I didn't.
I'll check the tape. Hopefully the tape checks out and we can worry about this contradiction later. But no, there's something about the truth coming from comedians. I feel like comedians tell us the truth and that's why we respect them. So in terms of what we were just discussing, you're releasing a record called The Many Moods of Donald Trump. And it's satire. Do you hope it, beyond making us laugh and entertaining us, do you hope it has some efficacy beyond that? Do you hope it makes people think about things that maybe they haven't contemplated?
Well, that would be nice. but I, you know, I think the kind of comedy I do is not, you know, silly comedy. I love silly comedy. It's just not what I do. But the thought that it might trigger something other than laughter in people, or something in addition to laughter in people, is sort of built into the form. I don't think it will have any other effect. Like I don't expect what I do to change minds or affect the larger political scene. I just think that's a sad fantasy for a comedian to have, and is a person who does have that entertain that fantasy is doomed to a lifetime of disappointment.
But you must in your history in entertainment, you must have seen, and we're seeing it a little bit now. If you count sort of social media platforms as being a vehicle for change on some level, because people are expressing themselves, maybe not with a song, maybe not with a comedy bit, but in some cases we've seen it now, a post, you know, some form of expression can actually trigger movements, action, change. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Except for the change part. I'm a bit of a skeptic. I would hope so, but I'm waiting for the winter.
The winter. Literally this, you're waiting for this. Oh, you're talking about COVID particularly?
No, I'm talking about, you know, people get out on the streets in the summertime and it looks like, ooh, this is for real. And then wintertime comes and it seems to go away. And I think the powers that be kind of count on that. Yeah. That the flame tends to go out.
Well, I mean, in satirizing Trump the way you have with this this new collection of songs and the videos you're making, I mean, it stands to reason that maybe more than some expressions, you're tapping into passion and reason, if I may use that cliche. Like to me, that's what satire is great at doing. It's sort of shining a light on the truths we don't really want to acknowledge, maybe a little bit, and it's also making us think and laugh and enjoy ourselves. But you leave at the end of it, I think, thinking differently a little bit. Ideally, I know you're saying this might be a false hope for a comedian, but surely you've experienced that kind of satire in the past by others, or maybe you've heard of the efficacy your work has had from fans.
If they like it and laugh, that's all I really expect, is I guess the best way to put it, you know?
Right.
Everything else is bonus.
Right. So now you've made a record. Traditionally, I would think you would tour something like this if you could. You put a band together or what have you. What are you doing as a performer? I know you did a performance some months ago as Derek Smalls, your character from Spinal Tap. Is that correct?
We did a full-on concert with not one but two orchestras.
That's right.
You know, rock and roll excess, baby. And shot it. It'll be out as a concert film pretty soon. I don't think this really would have lent itself to a touring kind of thing because, as I say, I want the illusion of that I get in the videos by making it seem like that's really Donald Trump singing this, and I don't think we could have achieved that on stage.
Right, right, okay.
So what we're doing is we're releasing a song a week, a Donald Trump song a week, during this fraught period. And a couple of videos. The first one was Son-in-Law, and then the next one will be a song called Executive Time. I don't know if you recognize that phrase that became known a couple of years ago. Somebody had freed up a White House schedule for the day, and there were a couple of events, and in between them were these large blocks, hours at a time, called Executive Time, where basically that's when he sits around and watches Fox. And so... this is a song where he's just indulging in executive time, and you get to see what it looks like in action, or in inaction.
Right. We've talked about this a little bit in other other aspects. You invoke 1968 as this maybe similar period. Have you ever seen a figure like Trump in your lifetime, Harry, ascend to power in this way? For a lot of us, everything that's happening is unprecedented, but like I say, you've been around a while. Have you ever seen the likes of this?
No, and I think by the same token, I don't think we had since the Great Depression an economic shock like 2008-2009 where the response FDR, you read your history, he ran for office on a platform 180 degrees different from what he ended up doing to respond to the Depression. Mm-hmm. He adjusted his sights dramatically and diametrically opposed to what he had said he was going to do because the situation was so dire. I think we had a response in most of the West to the 2008 Great Recession, so-called, that was quite a bit paler, less robust, shall we say, and left a lot more people feeling like the government didn't care about them, didn't, you know, cared about the bankers, but didn't care about them. And that set the table for not just this in the United States, but the de-democratization of some of Europe. Example, Hungary, Poland, so forth. And no, I can't recall anything like this. You know, there was a story in the New York Times a couple months ago. The new German anti-Semitism. Gee, the old one was so good, but they went back to the lab.
It's like new Coke. That's not good.
Yeah, exactly. But even more poisonous.
Right.
I think we really, you know, the undeniably important historical milestone of electing the first black president in the United States blinded a lot of us to the fact that the response to that economic downturn was insufficient and didn't reach a lot of people who were really suffering and who lost, you know, millions of people in the United States lost jobs and lost homes.
Right.
And, you know, we're talking now about, the eviction moratorium may be ending. Well, there was no eviction moratorium or foreclosure moratorium in 2009.
Yeah, right, right, exactly.
People lost homes, screw them.
Mm. You know,
and they basically have said, screw you right back. That's what Donald Trump is.
There's a phrase, of course, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. You invoked Nixon. You invoked Ronald Reagan becoming president as an actor. There's so many parallels between some aspects of this time we're living. These 4 years with Trump seem like, you know, particularly in your country, like you've lived all this before. I don't know what's going on there in terms of not learning from history or just repeating. Like, it just seems like we are on a loop. And you mentioned the new Nazis or whatever it was, the new anti-Semites.
The new German anti-Semitism.
Yeah. So what's going on there, do you think?
Well, what's going on here is that history is a word of in America that is a synonym for rubbish. Hmm. You know, he's history.
Right. Right.
We do not pay attention to history. One reason I like to live in New Orleans is because that city does and reveres its history and protects it and preserves it. But, you know, Ronald Reagan was not Donald Trump. Ronald Reagan had been governor of California for 8 years. Mm-hmm. He had experience. I mean, not as a good governor, but he knew what the job entailed. I think Donald Trump thought all the evidence from the many books that have come out, particularly Michael Wolff's book way at the beginning, is that he never expected to be elected. This was a brand enhancement exercise for him, you know, just a way to get the name around a lot. And he was shocked. And he'd even fired Chris Christie, who had organized for a possible transition in case he won. And so even the preparation that was made was tossed out. It's very much like that reminds me of the work that had been done, I think, in the State Department for like what happens after we get rid of Saddam Hussein. And right. They just threw that book away and started improvising. And that worked out real fine, too. sending the army home with their guns. What could they possibly do then? And Trump has just been trying to replicate, in my opinion, what it was like to run a family-owned company where he had no stockholders or board of directors to answer to, and mainly, you know, family to work for him. And his frustration, I think, has been long-standing in that the presidency isn't like that. There are all these alternative power centers, Congress and the courts and, you know, bureaucracies inside the executive branch. And I don't think he yet conceives of what this thing really is. And so I don't think we've ever had somebody who so little understood what the job of the presidency was.
Right. But it's also, as we've discussed earlier, in terms of the manipulation of the media and the manipulation of information, what we're talking about, I find fascinating because we're talking about ahistoricism on the one hand, but what he's also and his cohort are really into is cultural erasure. So you've got not only ignoring the past, but also those who invoke it or those who they represent progress. There seems to be a movement towards just shutting them down, ignoring them, or in some cases, something more severe. Do you see where I'm coming from there?
Yeah, you know, I guess I differ in this way, and what you're saying sounds to me very, if I may, American, in that I think liberals in America have this notion that progress is linear, and I think that ignores the reality that America is a very pendular country. It moves in these very strong pendular motions. So gambling is prohibited everywhere, and now 20, 30 years later, gambling is permitted everywhere.
Right.
Cannabis was forbidden everywhere, and now cannabis is permitted everywhere. And it swings back and forth on a lot of these factors of the social fabric. And the key one, I think, in this particular moment is everybody assumed, everybody on the liberal side, assumed that the election of the first black president was turning the page and a arrow pointing straight ahead.
Hmm.
And it could have been predicted that there would be in a country still denying and grappling with the legacy of slavery, there would have been a fierce and fearsome backlash. And we are, and that also is the cause of Trumpism.
So we are ostensibly chatting because you have conceived of a record that is criticizing Trump, and he made
it's making fun of him.
Making fun of Trump specifically. He is an avatar of conservatism, but as we talk, it seems to me that you have just as many criticisms, not as many issues. I shouldn't say as many, but you seem to view liberalism as similarly, I'm going to be careful here. I don't think you think it's as complicit. You have issues with liberalism that need to be addressed, that you feel like we should be addressing as well as making fun of someone like Trump.
Well, I say what I see.
Right.
And, you know?
And sometimes people don't appreciate being told the truth from people like you, I think, maybe. Is that fair to say?
Have you? Oh, I think it's fair to say.
Are we?
I think it's more than fair.
Right. So in the, you know, I invoke this notion of being hyperpolarized right now. What you're saying cuts to the core of where we need to be kind of thinking. Like, it's not a left-right and one is wrong and one is correct situation. We really need to examine how we function as a whole and not just pick a side, pick a team and just go all in on that team. We have to be more rational and reasonable. And I don't mean to use the phrase down the middle because people think that means watered down, but it's sort of true, isn't it?
Well, it's cafeteria politics, you know? It's like somebody may have a good idea on one side or the other, and the fact that they're on that side and you're not doesn't mean that you shouldn't consider that idea. That's not to say that there's a quality or equivalence of the number of good ideas that occur on one side or the other. I'm not sure I believe that either.
Yeah.
But I do think that the view of progress as linear gets people in trouble because it's in contrast with the way America works, which is these wild back and forth swings.
Fair enough. That's fair enough. I appreciate that. We've been talking about history and timelines, and you're talking about linear time. Are you familiar with this whole notion of the Simpsons predict the future?
Yeah.
So I'm of two minds of it. Like, initially I was like, that's kind of interesting how often that show sort of did seem to be on, you know, prescient about things, but I'm more now thinking it was like a self-fulfilling prophecy or something. Like maybe, you know,
The United States is obeying the Simpsons?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe something's going on there where at the heart of it, like if for the Simpsons to predict something, so to speak, 20 years ago and then for it to happen, I don't mean it's like obeying the Simpsons, but maybe as a show, as the writing staff, as the cast, you were kind of onto something. It goes back to my comedy getting at the truth of things. that didn't really spread into national consciousness until maybe two decades, you know? Maybe this stuff is vapid. Maybe this is ridiculous. What is your take on this whole Simpsons predict the future stuff?
Well, I'm not on the writing staff. I'm not part of that process at the show. So I have very little insight into how that any of that works. I know that in my own experience, I've made kind of what I'd call intuitive leaps about characters without knowledge, and found out later on that it was true. The silliest example was there used to be this American sportscaster called Kurt Gowdy, and my colleagues in a comedy group and I were doing spurious coverage of the Rose Parade, probably the silliest public event in America.
Yeah.
You know, a million people gathered to watch commercials made of flowers. And Kurt Gowdy was one of the guests on the coverage, and somebody asked why he seems so alert in the morning. He says, "Well, I'm never really good until I've had my morning cup of Cuddy," meaning Cuddy Sark.
Right.
And years later, I found out that was his beverage of choice. But it just, you know, it was an intuitive blurt. And sometimes those things, you know, if you're free enough and you know just enough, you can hit the mark without ever knowing it or knowing why you hit it. So it may be that. I don't think there's a cabal that's sitting there, trying to predict the future at The Simpsons. I think they got a show to do.
No, it just goes back to when I say comedy gets to the truth of things. I do think. Do you agree? Like, I feel like comedians tend to have their finger on the pulse, if I may use another cliche, of how we function and what our impulses might be. Even like, I do think there is a prescient notion to getting at the. It comes across as prescient when you tell the truth. And so when you tell the truth.
Well, I think given the amount of mendacity in modern culture, it comes as a surprise when you tell the truth.
Right. Exactly. And so that's why people are freaking out that The Simpsons knows everything, when really I think they were just telling the truth a little bit ahead of when we were ready to all process it. Does that make sense?
You know, I mentioned the prevalence of mendacity, and I've been thinking a lot about advertising lately. I was as a kid, I believed in brand names, and I'd pester my mom if she got the off-brand canned peaches or something like that.
Right.
And then I worked in the advertising business for a while as a kid. I was an intern at a big advertising agency in New York, and I started, you know, getting to know the truth about all this. My mom ran a gas station, improbably enough, for a while, and it was a Texaco station.
Right.
And one day I saw the tanker truck coming in to fill up the tanks at the gas station, and it was Chevron. I said, "Hey, I thought we were a Texaco station." She said, "They send the truck from the nearest refinery," that's all I'm saying. And that just blows all this careful brand identity building to smithereens.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I've had other experiences like that strengthened that. And I think there's a wonderful book by Tim Wu at Columbia University called The Attention Merchants. And it's about the century and a half that the advertising business has spent, you know, clawing more share of America's and maybe the world's eyeballs.
Right.
And hence brains. And I thought, you know, people in Britain would always say, "Why are Americans so stupid?" And I thought, well, no, I mean, the intelligence is pretty much distributed evenly across the
right.
the species. So what's going on here? And I thought, well, it might be nice to have a mega study of different countries, their responses on some sort of general knowledge quiz that could be culturally related so that it's appropriate to each different country.
Right.
And compare that with the amount of advertising people are exposed to in each country. I think advertising colonizes parts of the brain that could otherwise be used for information.
That's fair. And I actually have been finding that some of this lockdown stuff has been rather illuminating on a vocational level. Like, I don't know, Harry, are The Simpsons in production right now?
Yes.
Are you working from home?
Yeah.
Isn't that I'm working from home? And for years, I've said, I don't understand why I have to take this laptop that you gave me from my house to an office. Like, I'm taking the exact computer and I'm taking a 2-hour train, and I could just do this from home. And they'd say, "No, you can't do that. That's not how it works." What I've been finding is actually the truth is, we can do a lot of things that they told us we couldn't do. Are you finding that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what happened with The Simpsons. I'd say, I have a studio. I do a radio show from it every week. I can do this from home. No, you have to the better equipment, blah, 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 blah. And the minute the coronavirus thing happened, they sent me a microphone and say, do it from home.
That's right. So there's something going on here. I feel like most of our talk has been about the truth, and I appreciate your, allegiance and, fandom of the truth. I feel like your affinity for the truth has held us all in good stead, Harry, if I might say. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
So anything new in Springfield these days that you want to share or anywhere else? We've talked a lot about the Trump record, but anything else you're up to?
I have a movie that I'm struggling to get made, a musical comedy, but I really can't say anything more about it until the old green light flashes.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's a big project, and I've got a lot of really wonderful people involved.
I assume the coronavirus stuff is not helping move things along at this point. Is that fair?
I would say nothing is helping move this thing along. I think Earth is not helping move this thing along.
Right.
It's such a process.
Right.
It's amazing.
Okay. In terms of, so everything else, you're doing The Simpsons. Everything's great. My son is very obsessed with Mr. Burns, I must say, and Smithers. So just so you know, he's 9. And I don't know how he even – I'm starting to worry. He's finding stuff out. That I'm trying to be all controlling, and make sure he doesn't get the wrong stuff. And he's found The Simpsons. And we've been having fun doing impressions of those characters. I actually wonder, do you get people doing impressions of your voices to you? And is it often annoying, or are you flattered? How do you feel?
I don't often get that. I think people have... this is going to be strange for me to say. More common sense than that. But there is a guy... who has been posting his impressions of Simpsons voices on my Twitter feed.
Oh, no.
And I do wish he would stop.
Okay, right.
not that I watch it, but it's just like, dude, why do you think I would... ...
Okay, I think I understand, but are you personally... Is it a personal affront? You've created this thing, or is it just like it's a hack move to do an impression to the guy who did the voice?
It's basically like he's campaigning for my job.
Oh, right. Exactly. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I understand.
That,
right.
that strikes me as unseemly.
Yes, it does. You know what? I agree with you. In a world of unseemly behavior that we've been addressing today, that seems particularly bad. I would agree. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate this time. Harry, if people want to learn more about you and the many moods of Donald Trump and all your work, is there somewhere on the internet that you would like to send them?
I have a website, harryshearer.com. You can get my radio show there every week. And the first two Donald Trump songs are on YouTube, just YouTube, Harry Shearer. And you should find Son-in-Law and COVID-180.
Okay. Now, if we can go out on perhaps one of those songs, would you, A, permit it, and B, would you choose one of them for us to hear?
I think... How much time do you have?
Oh, it doesn't matter. It's a podcast. It's the Wild West.
Oh, okay. Well, I think COVID-180 because we're still living through it.
Okay. Anything you want to say about it in particular? You've taken a particular... Well, is it all evident in the
yeah,
lyrics?
It's basically just like what we've been living through. Coming from the Donald.
Right. Yes. Okay. All right. Well, let's go to that right now. This is COVID-180 from the many moods of Donald Trump by the great Harry Shearer. Harry, thank you so much for this time and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you, Vish.
Whole month of February, it's under control. Just a few cases, then we rock and we roll. The market's like a rocket, it's on Twitter and Reddit. You could call me crazy, but I'm taking credit. Corona's just a neighborhood in Queens. We're number one.
That we're in a kind of spiral, but a big part of leadership is going viral.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
You know, every once in a while I think, who am I going to get on this show that I would love to have on the show? And you know, you have your mental front of mind people that you think of, you know, the obvious things. And then as you go on and you make a podcast every week, you just stumble into things. You fall ass backwards into talking to people you have admired most of your life and you just hadn't thought to think that you could get them on your show. And then your friend Jason Schneider, publicist in Canada, says, Harry Shearer is available to chat, and you think, oh my goodness, I've been a fan of Harry Shearer most of my life. Wouldn't it be great to have Harry Shearer on the show? And then it happens. And then you have a discussion like I just did. Thank you very much for listening to this episode with Harry Shearer. This is the 558th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available on all Apple and Google platforms and Spotify and YouTube and other things as well. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and are looking for, or if you wish to learn more about me, and sign up for my semi-regularly scheduled newsletter, I urge you to visit my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on various social media platforms and follow the show on Twitter, at vishcreative or at vishkana if you want to follow me directly. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. You can start to with any amount you want. $6, $8, $9, $10, $3,500 a month. Whatever you want to donate at the end of the month, I think you can change it. I know. If you're like, I can't do 9 anymore, I want to do 7, or I can't do 6, I got to go down to 1. Totally understandable, but it supports the show, and there's exclusive content for anyone who donates $6 or more. So please go to patreon.com/creativecontrol to support this show. Thanks again to Live at MasseyHall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. Also, for their in-kind support of this show, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. Can't do the show without them, although I haven't partaken of the in-kind part of this, these deals in a while. But that's fine. I love them so much, and I hope they're doing well in all of this chaos, and hopefully I will sample their wares someday again. Thanks, as always, to Jim Guthrie. He lends me some music for the show, and you can learn more about him at jimguthrie.org. And finally, as I said, I think at the top of all of this little spiel here, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode with the legendary Harry Shearer and for checking out past episodes of the show, maybe subscribing to the podcast and telling your friends about it as well. All of that helps, and I will continue to make podcasts as long as you want me to, and I think some of you do, so I'm going to keep going. And until then, I will, you know, I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.